Hello guys, welcome to the Blackspin Global Podcast. I am Lucy.
And I'm Eugene.
And welcome to a special episode. First of all, happy Black History Month to our US listeners.
Happy Black History Month.
Even though it's Black History Month every day, every minute, every second.
Every day.
Word to Whitney Houston. Exactly. So today is a very special episode. As some of you may be aware, this year marks the 50th anniversary since Arthur Ashe has won his first Wimbledon title. And instead of just celebrating for just one podcast, one moment during grass season, throughout this year, Blackspin Global will be celebrating the legacy of Arthur Ashe and also his run winning Wimbledon. What makes this even more special, we are actually in collaboration with the Arthur Ashe legacy at UCLA. So everything that you're getting here is accurate info. And it's not Wikipedia, it's not ChatGPT, it's not, you know, it is legit information. And we are very thankful and grateful for them reaching out to us for us to share the stories. A lot of these things are things that people are not aware of or Arthur not getting the credit that he should be credited for. So how do you feel, Eugene, about having this?
Very well said, Lucy. And just again, like, need to give UCLA massive props because... yeah, they've given us access to a lot of like important and like, yeah, just incredible archive material that we've been kind of lucky to have access to.
Yeah.
And you will be hearing that throughout the pod as well. So.
Yeah, for sure. And in different forms of content, not just a podcast, social, like we're really looking forward to sharing all of this. So make sure that you guys stay tuned, you follow, you subscribe, everything. And this is not going to be your typical boring long type of story. Like, you're really gonna hear some stuff and be like, wow, I did not know this information. So again, thank you very much to the Arthur Ashe legacy team at UCLA. Before we start off on what we're going to talk about today, it's only right to give a brief introduction of the man himself, right? So Arthur Ashe, legendary player, civil rights activist, humanitarian, who was the first Black man to win the Grand Slam titles at the US Open 1968, Australian Open 1970, Wimbledon 1975. He's known for his calm demeanor and strategic play, and he obviously broke racial barriers in such a predominantly white sport. Beyond tennis, however, he was a very vocal advocate for racial equality, education, and AIDS awareness, as well as a very strong advocate for players' rights. So, in a special episode, actually, we are going to share how Arthur Ashe played a pivotal role in forming the Association of Tennis Professionals known as the ATP. And before we actually go really deep into that, I do want to give Eugene his props for picking this topic, because I'm not going to lie, I was stuck. I was like, so what? How are we going to introduce this? What are we going to do? We have all this information. And the main reason why I'm so happy that you suggested this is because it's actually not really known, first of all, that you had so much to do with how the ATP is formed today. And even when you do like research and stuff, I'm like, hello?
Very little information. Because for me, it kind of, it struck me when we were doing our Wimbledon special episode. Mm-hmm. The research that we did off the back of that, that's when I found out that, he played a pivotal role in kind of forming the ATP as it's known today. Mm-hmm. Obviously you'll hear it kind of throughout this episode, but he was really kind of passionate about players' rights across the board. And also he played a massive role in just kind of expanding the sport to like a wider audience, which we'll touch on later on.
And when he was president, what changes do you think he made that were beneficial for players?
I think he just, at that point early in the ATP, that he's just solidifying our power and as speaking out as players. Mm-hmm. And he just, he was the first Black president of the ATP, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And he just, he was a great, he was a good president for the ATP. He was soft spoken, but he, you know, believed in what the players had to say in the game, and he stood up for our rights.
Mm-hmm. So before we actually really get into how he helped form the ATP, we just want to share a little bit of what type of man Arthur was and why it made sense as to him being so, you know, advocate about players' rights. So as some of you may know, he was at the College of, the College at University of California, UCLA. Los Angeles, UCLA. He went through a scholarship, actually. And while he was there, he also played tennis. He also served his country from 66 to 68 after he graduated.
Just on the college as well, he studied business administration, which I think is also quite apt, considering, like, yeah, the kind of role he played in forming the ATP. Like, obviously, he kind of had that business, like, mind, like, administration as well. Like,
yeah, makes sense.
It does.
Probably
it does.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why because one thing that I've noticed a lot of people talking about how calm he was, how he knew how to communicate to different type of people to make sure, like, they were getting the right message of what he was trying to say. And not everyone has that skill.
I was going to say, it's a massive skill.
Yeah, exactly. Not everyone has that skill. So, yeah, we get to 1968, September, and then he wins his first US Open against Tom Okker.
Okker, yeah.
From the Netherlands. And because of his amateur status as an active lieutenant, he actually could not accept the prize money.
Crazy.
It's crazy. And he had to give it to the opponent, which I find even crazier. It's like, at least no one gets the money, just a trophy and walk off, you know, but whatever. But that was such a special moment because in 1968, that was when the Civil Rights Act was passed. And also where he won the US Open was at a tennis club that actually did not have any black members. So he had all of that, didn't get the prize money.
Which is, the prize money was what, $14,000?
$14,000 at the time. I'm really curious to know how much that is in today's. Millions, hopefully. I don't know.
I don't know.
Do you
about
think
that.
So?
I don't know about that. But $14,000 US Open terms, just in terms of today, that's what? That's not even first round. Like, you get more for
real.
Winning, you get more for losing in the
true.
First round.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, obviously, equivalent to back then, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, that was definitely, like, a lot of money. Yeah. But either way, despite all of that, after his win, he apparently told his brother, Johnny Ash, "I'm a champion now and people will listen to me." So he knew that after this, things would change. Following his title win in 1969, he actually co-founded the National Junior Tennis League with Charlie Passero, who's Ash's teammate at UCLA at the time, and also the actual founder of Indian Wells. Oh, and Indian Wells is just about to come around soon. So shout out to Indian Wells. And Sheridan Snyder, who apparently was like a business person, but he was a tennis enthusiast. Tennis, so he was very into tennis. So the program was designed to expose children to tennis who might not otherwise have opportunities to play, while fostering a sense of discipline and attention to academics. One thing also that I've noticed a lot about Ash's story is that apparently he was very big on education. Yeah. There was a lot of stories also about, like, him always wanted to learn things about, like, someone else's country or politics. So he would meet, like, a player from whatever country and he would try to, like, get an understanding, like, asking questions like, "Oh, what's this like? Or what's that like?" And yeah, so he felt like education was key. It didn't matter the fact that he was a tennis player, which is pretty amazing. And today, that same network features more than 350 nonprofit youth development organizations that offer free or low-cost tennis and education programming to more than 200,000 under-resourced youth each year. And it's actually under the USTA today. And
that's legacy. Like, that's
exactly. After all of these years. And even that, one of the luminaries in there is actually former top 10 ATP player and current Miami Open tournament director, James Blake.
Shout out.
And he actually spoke a lot about how that helped him and how that helped him understand the importance of education. He was very vocal about that. So, yeah, all of this really shows how much Arthur Ashe wanted to make a difference and make sure that everyone had some form of equal opportunity.
I know that Ashe was, at first, he was the vice president, and later he became president. But what was did he ever talk to you about his thoughts about the opposition that you all were receiving from the tennis world, that they were receiving from the tennis world, or about how, you know, what it meant to him? Did you ever have conversations with him
about? I had lots of conversations with Arthur. Yeah, I mean, he felt just like everybody else did. Mm-hmm. That he was fed to the teeth with being told what to do by a bunch of anti-proud professional tennis players. Mm-hmm. And he felt very, very strongly, like everyone else, that the time had come for the players to run their own show, because nobody knew better how it should be run than the players.
So, the impact of tennis. There's a reason why, well, we're going to talk about this very, 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 very quickly, because when something gets big, it gets out of control and, you know, no one's following rules, money's flowing, everyone's doing whatever they want. But so when it came, tennis really got very popular around the 70s, mainly because the championships started showing up. So like the Grand Slam, US Open, Wimbledon, Australia Open, they started showing up on cable, so on TV. So that was like a really big deal. And on top of that, you then had more tennis players becoming stars due to their characters and their playing style. And in fact, even tennis journalist Richard Evans, he actually said Ash had a lot to do with bringing in more people.
The rise, the popularity.
Yeah, so himself literally got more people into tennis, and that was very important. So during that time, there was a lot of boom. And because of that, the sport was gaining more popularity, bringing in more money. And this is why it was then a little bit more important for the ATP to start getting involved.
So let's talk about ATP and the forming of it, because now you have the open era. The players have a little more sway and a little more power, and they start to consolidate some of that power into these organizations. I know there was ATP, and then there was maybe another organization, and then Pro Council. Can you talk a little bit about these different groups that were forming?
Well, Yolanda, in the 70s, I was really kind of dealing with a different career. I built a 10 indoor court facility in St. Louis. I also had a business with Sports Illustrated, which we managed the Rock Resort tennis facilities. I was also doing some TV work. I did like 13 shows for ABC, some for WCT on NBC. So I was not really that connected to what was going on with the ATP. Mm-hmm. Arthur and Stan and Charlie Passerell, Cliff Drysdale, those guys were the real developers of the ATP. They were the guys that were really pushing for the association and dealt with it. You know, with Lamar Hunt's group, a lot of those guys were still under contract. But it changed in that the fact that they were now putting together the ranking system. And it was a way for players to enter into the tournaments. And it obviously, you know, changed the world. And part of that was the Men's Pro Council was developed. And that was comprised of the ITF, which was really the Grand Slams, tournament directors, which were worldwide. So there were three ITF representatives. There were three player representatives, and there were three tournament director representatives. And that was the governing body of the sport. They made the calendar. They basically dealt with whatever issues were politically involved in tennis. That was all handled by the Men's Pro Council.
Prior to that, the ATP way was going, the players had little, very, very, very little control over their careers. First of all, it was governed a lot by organizations, mainly like the nationals, so like the LTA today, USTA.
The International Tennis
International, Federation, yeah, so ITF. And, yeah, and so on. So some of the things that they had little control of was the scheduling, distribution of prize money. So some players were literally getting more money than the others. Some tournament, they were just doing whatever they wanted.
Also, players were like kind of accepting, well, some tournaments weren't paying. So players were getting paid like kind of under the table.
Exactly.
Which is obviously like, well, it's illegal.
Yeah. Well,
that's a way for them to earn money.
Yeah.
So there was like no regulation basically until, yeah, the ATP kind of stepped in and like basically just structured things like to just make it more fair. Everybody basically.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so the players that were very vocal about this were top players like Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall, and especially Arthur Ashe. And they were very vocal about the poor working conditions each time. And then they had just had enough, to be honest. That's just like the easiest way to put it out. They had enough. And then you had Donald Dell, Jack Cramer, and Cliff Drysdale. I hope I'm pronouncing these names
right. Yeah, that's all correct.
Hey, shout out to me. they led the charge to form a union for male players, where Cliff became the first ATP president, with Arthur Ashe players joining. There was, when I was doing the research, it's funny because people only mention the fact that he was president, but I don't think it's really mentioned how he was like one of the key players.
Yeah, or founders.
Or founders, yeah. For example, on the Washington, well, City Open website, it literally says founder of the ATP. Yeah, yeah. So it's funny. So some of you like to give credit, some are not giving credit. I don't know. Maybe I have to go back and fact check and put some respect on Mr. Arthur Ashe. But what really made a shift to the ATP and for everyone else to take the ATP more seriously was the Wimbledon boycott. In 1973, Croatian player Nikola Pilic. He was banned from Wimbledon by his own national federation because he skipped the Davis Cup. So as we said earlier, they had all control. They could call up a tournament and say, this player's not playing and it will be done. And the ATP just had enough. They felt like it was an unfair decision against players' right to choose which events they want to play. So in protest, 81 ATP players, including Ashe, boycotted Wimbledon, proving that the ATP could stand up to tennis authorities. And this was a turning point. This is when they were like, oh, okay, maybe we need to listen.
Just also on that boycott as well, they weren't just like random players. They were, I don't want to say the exact numbers, I don't have them here, the exact figures, but a lot of them were seeds. So like a lot of the top players,
yeah,
in the event boycotting, like kind of in support of Pilic.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it was such a groundbreaking moment.
Mm-hmm.
That is why, like, yeah, the ATP, they kind of earned their stripes, if that makes sense, in showing that, yeah, that we're a force here. Yeah. Like, basically, the players,
for sure,
we are the ones that are in control. So, yeah, a really, really significant moment.
For sure. Yeah.
And what was the outcome of the boycott?
Well, everything started to change. The ATP got stronger, yeah, and the National Associations didn't control the players. A lot of the players were under contract to Lamar Hunt. And then there was another boycott, I think in 1974, in which WCT had the majority of players under contract. I don't know if Arthur was, but I think he was, because I think he used to play those events. And there, I guess there was some negotiation with Wimbledon about contract players playing, and they couldn't come to agreement. So WCT pulled the players out. Mm-hmm. And that was also, you know, a very radical thing that happened. And I'm not really sure of all the fallout of that, but I think that's where we ended up coming up with the Men's Pro Council and dealing with those type of events. Mm-hmm. At the Men's Pro Council level. Arthur was in the middle of all of this.
Wow.
Arthur and Charlie Passerell, Stan Smith were real leaders in making these changes.
Wow. And then following that year, Arthur Ashe became the first Black ATP president. And he just used his position to continue advocating for fair prize money, equal opportunities for players from all backgrounds. I think that's one thing that I admire the most about reading about this man is the fact that it wasn't, obviously he, it's crazy because at that time, segregation was crazy. Even though the Civil Rights Act was passed, there was still, the racism was still there.
Oh, it was rife, yeah.
But he was vocal about
everybody,
which is, that kind of even got him a little bit in trouble with the black community. Some of the black people were a bit like, why are you doing, especially already he's playing in a sport where it was mainly for white people. But is after years after that, a lot of people actually understood that, you know, what he was trying to do and why that was still important. It's unfortunate that at that moment, some couldn't understand it because he was a little bit judged and stuff. And I remember even reading where he said, I think a lot of activists wanted him to be a lot more vocal about the rights, the way he was, especially with tennis. But he believed that, let me play my game, let me be the biggest star in tennis so then I can use my platform and my voice through
exactly
that
what he did, yeah.
to speak up. And he did that. So I'm glad that he could have just stopped. He could have just been like, I'm not doing this anymore. The comments from people who felt like he left the community could have gotten to him, but he did it, and it actually did make an impact all around as well, and in tennis as well, which is massive, pretty great to see. And the fact that he was dealing with that and then still doing it in tennis, where it's just white people, I think people really underestimate that impact as well. And you know what that remind me of? Naomi Osaka.
I knew you were going to go there. Yeah, no, completely. And for me, it's legacy again, mm-hmm. like, because it's his legacy kind of living on in today's examples. Yeah. Like you said, Osaka, Coco Gauff, she's been vocal as well, yeah. like, with certain race-related issues. Mm-hmm.
Francis Tiafoe as well.
Basically, all the black players today, they've kind of said something at one point in their young careers,
yeah.
which we've also had our own kind of, well, opinions and thoughts, for sure. shared them on the podcast before.
But yeah.
That is literally Arthur Ashe's legacy right there, like in today's world. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's huge. And like, again, it just shows the kind of the power and the just how amazing he was. Like that, you know, so many years after his passing, mm-hmm. like people are still talking about him. But yet there are still so many stories that are unknown. Hence yeah. why look at us here right now talking about the ATP
For sure.
and his kind of
yeah.
role in forming that. So
definitely.
Yeah, so important. Mm-hmm.
Arthur was the first guy off the block to say we needed a professional administration. He was saying that beginning in 1974. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't get it until 1981. Mm-hmm. But he never relinquished the idea that the tennis needed a professional administration, that it needed a code of conduct, and that it needed organized rules that the players and the tournaments and the public understood. So Arthur and Cliff Drysdale and John Newcomb and Stan Smith were sort of the nucleus of the first board of directors of the Players Association, the first leaders. Mm-hmm. And so their attitude was, treat us like professionals. We'll pay our own expenses, put the money up, and we'll play for it.
So in terms of Ashe's ATP influences, and we're going to talk about those, whether he was a president or not, he made those influences. A lot of things here that you probably did not know. For instance, let's start with something a little bit easy.
Like
Washington Open, also known as City Open today. Eugene, did you know that he's actually one of the co-founders of the City Open?
I did not know that.
No.
I did not know that.
And I bet you didn't either. So a year after actually he won his US Open, he suggested to Donald Dell to run a tournament in Washington under one condition. Instead of having it in a club, he said it has to be in an integrated area so black faces can come out and watch the tennis. If you do it at a public park, a public facility, and not a country club, I'll play the event.
Powerful.
And that is how we had it. Technically, this could have been named as like the first ATP tournament, but because he was like the president and stuff, I think he couldn't really make it that official and stuff. Okay. But yeah, so he is actually one of the main reasons why the City Open is there and also had black faces there, which is pretty cool.
Also as well, like, not to kind of, yeah, if we talk about City Open today,
mm-hmm.
probably one of the blackest events in terms for of sure. the faces in the crowd.
Yeah.
And we've said that before as well.
Like, that's true.
I want to say again, that is like, that's not an accident.
True, true. There is definitely, and from what, obviously, as you guys can hear, our accent from the UK, but from what I've known is that there is like a very strong...
Yeah, black community.
Big black community in DC. So there's that as well. Like, it's a thing of like when the black people come together, they really come together there. So yeah, so that's really, really dope to see. Arthur Ashe also played a key role in influencing the WCT decision to take the event to Lagos, Nigeria. He had been to Nigeria in 1970 with the one and only Stan Smith. Kind of wish I wore my Stan Smith now. as part of the US State Department Goodwill Tour. And this is very important because at that time, there was actually a lot of like government political issue in Nigeria with the military coup and so on. Like, there were even protests in front of the US embassy and stuff. So he wanted to make sure that we promote tennis in these places. So the Lagos Lawn Tennis Club fulfilled every WCT condition to host the event, which included providing the prize money for the singles and doubles tournaments and building for a new center court. And the World Championship Tennis signed a 5-year agreement to the Lagos Lawn Tennis Club to host an annual series of the tennis tournaments in Lagos. What I liked the most about this is that it actually allowed Nigeria's two best players, Lawrence Awopegba, I hope I pronounced that Awopegba, well. Yep. I actually did a little bit more research on him. He actually ended up being like a very important person in Nigeria in terms of like the tennis there. Yeah. So even when he unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, and when he passed away, there were literally even talks about like what's going to happen to tennis in Nigeria. That's how much influence he had. And also Yemisi Allen, I unfortunately couldn't find much about him, but they were given wild card entries to compete against the top tennis players, which is really dope because there was literally top players that were going to Lagos to play.
And again, on that as well, like what we kind of say all the time, like, when are we going to get a tournament, a WTA 250 or ATP 250 in Africa? And when we say, we mean like, yeah, sub-Saharan Africa. Like, when is that going to happen?
Yeah.
I wouldn't, obviously it's like hindsight or whatever, like, but yeah, if Ash was still alive today, I feel like we would have one.
100,000%. Because he would have been knocking at them doors. So yeah, I'm hoping someone at the ATP is listening to this. So like, maybe, you know, especially today, like we have some black countries where we can have those facilities. It could be Senegal. Hey, it could be Ghana, where the African Games was at well.
Yeah,
could be Nigeria. Like to be honest, there are
a lot of like ITF events and exactly. like lower level like challenges in a lot of like, yeah, African countries.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of like bigger events, we don't have that.
Yeah.
And you'd like to think we're not too far. Hopefully we're not too far from that happening.
Really hope not.
Nigeria, yeah, that was a WCT tournament, and how they picked Nigeria, we don't know, because it was in Lagos and hot and humid, and I think their government was a little unstable at that time. But while we were there, they had a coup, and they killed the president just after our tournament started. So a lot of us players were at this hotel by the beach, and they rounded us up and took us to different homes by the US Embassy to stay for the remainder of our time there. Arthur was staying with the ambassador, I believe. He and Stan Smith, they were with the ambassador's hotel. So I'm not quite sure what they were doing at the time, but anyway, we couldn't, we stopped the tournament and couldn't play for a while under mandate from the government because they were searching for these guys that killed their president.
Can we go back a little bit? Like,
yeah.
while you're in the match, Were you playing the match? Was it your match that got stopped? And when you all learned about it?
Well, that was later on. Mm-hmm. We played opening matches, and then this assassination occurred, and so we were held up at friends of the ambassador's homes for several days, and then supposedly Johnny McDonald, who was our World Championship Tennis liaison, he said he got permission from the government for us to go back and finish the tournament. And so I went back on the court. We were in the semis at that time, and I was playing Dick Stockton. I finished my match with no problem, but then Arthur was playing Jeff Borowiak in the next match, and that's when the soldiers came on the court, and they with their machine guns, and we're telling everyone to, you know, where'd you get permission? You're not supposed to be here playing. And the people were rushing from the stands, and it was chaos and everything. I didn't see any of this because I was already back at where I was staying. Mm-hmm. And I heard stories later that Arthur was in the locker room, and this one soldier came in, what are you doing here? And get out of here. And so Arthur went running down the street and was picked up by a Dutch embassy car and taken back to the residence. So we never really finished the tournament. We stayed in our different respective places until they got us a jet to get us out of there. That was several days later.
South African Open. So South African Open actually already was in existence, but Ash Impact forced changes in how it was structured from 1973. There was a lot of stories on his South African
because of apartheid.
Trip. Yes. So the apartheid was enforced system of segregation based on race and South African government. It started from 1948, where apparently he actually back through the 19th century, so probably even before that. Mm. But yeah, it just meant the black people one side, white people one side, which is crazy to think in South Africa. South Africa, but yeah. I don't know, but yeah. But that also meant that sports teams were also segregated. But what was really powerful about his trip is that literally before he came, he told the government he does not want to play in front of a racial segregated audience and will not accept limitation of his free speech while in South Africa. And he actually tried to apply for visas so many times, and he got disapproved. And do you actually know why at the end he actually got approved? According to Owen Williams, it's because the South African government, they wanted to start making business with the Japanese. So they wanted Japan to come to the country, bring in some money, do some business. And there was basically like a visa for that. That is why at the end, well, one of the reasons why at the end, he actually ended up getting approved, which is so crazy.
But is it surprising?
Like, no. What does that mean? No, not at all. I'm pretty sure also, you know, the other things that happened with the tennis pushing, but that was like one of the main thing, which Ash was aware of. Unfortunately, he never really shared why, how he felt about it, and so on. But yeah, he was able to go to the country despite the policies, and he actually completed he competed in the tournament. And as Owen Williams said on the voiceover, he was a star. And one thing that really pushed him to even do this is that he had like a kid that was following him around. And yeah, it was like, it was crazy when he was there, as you can hear in the voiceover. And it just shows to you the impact, because a lot of people, it was more of like a shock, like, wow. I think if I remember correctly as well, someone actually said to him, like, this is the first time we are seeing a free black man.
Wow.
Which is crazy. And I want you guys to remember the year, 1973. It's not that far. Yeah. Don't let these black and white pictures make you think that this happened in 1870-something. In 1973. Remember that. Which is crazy. But, Yeah, that was a very big moment. Till this day, when you search on Arthur Ashe, there's a lot of talk about his South Africa trip. And stay tuned. We will discuss that one day, for sure.
You've got to know, it might have sounded dangerous. Arthur thought it was dangerous. Johannesburg was an English-speaking, therefore anti-Dutch, anti-government town. We went to great lengths to call ahead at restaurants every night. We decided we didn't have to. Johannesburg took Arthur Ashe to their hearts. When he came on the center court, he got thunderous applause. When he played the final against Jimmy Connors, which he lost, every ball, every winner he hit, by that stage we had 11,000 people. 11,000 people erupted like he was winning the Wimbledon final.
Wow.
But Yvonne Gulagong had found the same thing, because Johannesburg was predominantly English. See, South Africa had 5 million white people, and it was about 3 million English speaking and about 2 million Boers, but the 2 million Boers were the government.
Mm.
Of the 3 million English speaking people, they were liberal by name only.
Mm.
The Progressive Party was limited to the northern suburbs of Johannesburg. That's why we managed to vote Helen Suzman in year after year.
Mm-hmm.
But Ellis Park was in downtown Johannesburg, but on the fringes of the northern suburbs. The spectators were mostly northern suburbs, preponderously white, obviously, more Jewish than Boer. It was a very large Jewish population. They supported the arts like they do everywhere, and they supported my tennis tournaments by the thousands. And I got a tumultuous reception wherever he went.
Additional tournaments as an ATP president, including the World Tennis Cup, Nations Cup, with the first one being in Jamaica in 1975. I'm having oxtail for dinner as well, so this is perfect. Ash's aim with the event was to include a single location and tournament for all of the teams, as well as representation by the best players each country has to offer, not by those who could fit the tournament into their crammed schedule, which he was trying to suggest for the Davis Cup. And when I read that, I was like, huh.
I mean, till this day, like, we're still having that debate about
This is literally the reason why I keep on mentioning the Davis Cup.
But also, I do love the fact that, yeah, this World Tennis Cup or Nations Cup, it sounds very much, it sounds like the United Cup that we have.
Yes.
Today. Like, mm-hmm. I do like that.
For and sure.
It kind of shows as well, like, the saying of, like, history repeating itself.
For
like,
sure.
This is an example of that in terms of the United Cup today. In the Nations Cup, this was 1975. So it just shows tennis has always tried to find an event that like incorporates like the world, like cup element, but it hasn't quite found like that event yet.
For sure.
That like everybody kind of gravitates to and like supports as one.
Yeah.
But I like the idea. Like this Nations Cup sounded fun. Like,
yeah.
And to be in Jamaica too. Like vibes.
Hello. Like, good food. Good vibes. Good drinks. Tennis. Weather is great. They must have had a time.
What did you ask for?
Like honestly. So I don't know. Hey, VJK. I hope you're listening. Like help us out here. Like it's just crazy. Like when I read this, I was like this. Hello, like this is what we think. Because I think around the time when he announced this as well, I think people were a bit concerned that it was just like the Davis Cup. But he tried to suggest like, hey, we need to make the Davis Cup in one place so that everyone can calm down. And it's funny because they always compared BJK Cup and Davis Cup to the world, to the World Cup, like in terms of soccer for our US listeners.
I think the US listeners know football is football now. of course they have their NFL. No, but they know football.
Exactly, and NFL is soon. Please, let's just make a clarification. But and when you look at the World Cup, it's literally in one location. Mm. So if we are saying it's the same thing to that, why are we not making it in one location? And it's 2025 and we're talking about this. So, yeah, so that was a really, really, really good shout from Arthur, for sure.
How did his involvement continue in the council during your time?
Well, listen, every meeting Arthur Ashe is at, he is important. Mm-hmm. So people listen to him always. But don't forget, he was the second president of ATP. He followed Cliff Drysdale, was president in 72, 73. So 74, 75, Arthur was president. Mm-hmm. And then John Newcomb follows him for 2 years. But all of that time, he's on the board of ATP. Mm-hmm. So he is pretty much big time involved in setting the policy mm-hmm. for the Players Association. And also for the Men's Tennis Council mm-hmm. all those years. And he's still playing, by mm-hmm. the way. And God only knows what he was doing on the side as a civil rights leader.
Right.
Which was all sort of behind the scenes and undercover. Mm-hmm. We didn't know much about that at all.
So even after his ATP presidency, he was still out here making the differences. One of the key things that he made a difference of, which you actually mentioned, Eugene, was the code of conduct, the ATP code of conduct.
Which he wrote.
He wrote. They're not telling you that. Again, one more time. They're not telling you that Arthur Ashe is behind the code of conduct, which, do you know if it's even crazier? When you're actually searching for it, you find two articles. Like if you type in code of conduct, ATP, yeah. Arthur Ashe, ATP, you find two articles, one from the actual ATP.com website, and the other, the article, actually focuses more on the story behind without actually crediting Arthur Ashe. I'm going to need you guys to go wow. back and give the credit. Even the, actually no, the ATP Tour one, it does credit it, but again, it focuses more on the story behind, which I can understand. Unfortunately, it wasn't one of the greatest stories that pushed him to create this. So it was a match incident against
Ilya Anastasi.
Yes, I wanted to make sure that I pronounced that name right. During the Union Masters, known as the ATP final today, where Anastasi actually had bad sportsmanship due to Ashe benefiting some of the very close, cold lines. It was so bad, like his behavior was so bad that Ash literally walked off. Like he was stalling at times. There was one time he literally was like a 2 minute delay at one point. He was talking to the crowd. He was just doing whatever
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine that today? Tennis Twitter, he would have been done, finished. It would have been too much. So he was really upset. Ash walked off and then they were like, if you walk off, you're going to be disqualified, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. At the end, they were both ended up both being disqualified. But Ash wrote like a 5-page letter or something like that, like a very long letter, and was like, I know the rules. This is unfair. Da, 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 and so on.
You know that letter was well written.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. To the point.
Yeah. And it's funny because apparently Ash even said like in his first 10 years, like being a player, that was the first time he was so angry, upset. And there was a lot of like comments about how like they've never seen Arthur Ashe that upset, like so upset and stuff. So he wrote that long letter. At the end, he still ended up playing. But you know, with the ATP finals rules, basically with the rules, if he... I'm trying to remember correctly. Had he lost, Nastasi actually would have been able to continue to play. Yeah. But everyone applauded Arthur Ashe because he was still like because he won the match. He was, I think because of the scores and everything, you know how the ATP Tour final scores are and stuff. So basically, they
it's not straight knockout. It's like groups.
Exactly, yeah. Group knockouts. Yeah. So he didn't allow that situation do like anything and stuff. He still went into that court and was like, you know what, let me just forget about everything and still do what I had to do. So he won the match and Asante actually ended up still being able to play. And he could have, Ash could have just been petty and be like, you know what, let me actually, you know, try and not do my best here. So then you can't play and I can't play. Mm. But it just shows you the type of person that he was. He was a team player. He was a respectful person. Nasasi did apologize. He was, you know, he knew. I think because of Ash's behavior and the way that he was, I think he was just so taken back at how Ash actually got up and left and was like, oh, he actually left. Oh, shoot, he's really upset. So, you know, he apologized and stuff. But because of that incident, Ash was like, you know what? You guys are doing whatever you want.
We need some rules and regulations.
We need some rules here. And till this day, that same code of conduct is here today because of Arthur Ashe.
Legacy.
That's Black history right there. But yeah, so even after the ATP was formed, there was still being some frustration again. And they had the Men's Tennis Council, which was controlled by tournament organizers rather than players. So in 1988, ATP CEO Hamilton Jordan led a player revolt. Again, Arthur Ashe was very vocal about supporting the movement and backing players in demand for greater control. So that the ATP can actually take over the tour. It was like, all right, yeah. Although the ATP formed, it did help, but there were still some issues behind the scenes. And Ash's vision of pushing tennis in underrepresented regions, again, influenced the ATP to create more global tour. There's so many stories about him, you know, again, speaking to different players from different backgrounds. He sent a letter to the Asian tennis player, Michael Chang? Yes. And Michael Chang actually had...
Well, he was American-Asian.
He was American-Asian, yeah. Michael Chang actually had like a 60 Minutes interview or documentary.
Okay, yeah.
And he actually shared the letter that Arthur Ashe sent to him. Cool. And, you know, Ashe was basically trying to give him like a heads up, like, hey, you're going to be loved, but there's going to be this insane pressure on you. There's going to be a lot of people talking and so on and so on. And I know for the first time, for some people, it might be like, oh, this is going to, you know, ruin his confidence and stuff. But that was Ashe being like, hey, you are not like them. Like Ashe actually said on the letter, do you think I didn't want to shout about like McEnroe and stuff, like when things were going wrong? I could not afford to do that as a Black man. So just know, just because you're playing for America does not mean that rule is like different. I won't be surprised if Michael like actually read that the first time and be like, ooh, this is a bit, you know, but I'm pretty sure now today, as he got older, he was like, I see what you were trying to do here.
And we all miss Arthur. I went to both of his memorial services.
Mm-hmm.
Also went to the press conference he had when he announced he had AIDS.
Mm-hmm. So you were there in person?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I forget, it's probably 92 or... Mm-hmm. And by that time now, I'm the executive director of the USTA in the 90s. And we're working on the new tennis center and what would eventually become Arthur Ashe Stadium. And it had, before it could even go to the New York City Planning Commission, it had to be approved by 15 community boards that surround Flushing Meadow Corona Park, which is a 1,200-acre park in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur knew he was dying of AIDS at that stage of the game. He went to all 15 community association boards to promote the U.S. Open project, and they got it approved in every one of them. Mm-hmm. And without that, it couldn't even go to the Planning Commission or the City Council or the State of New York or the anybody else in New York. Mm-hmm. It had to go through that, and that's the kind of man Arthur Ashe was.
Wow.
I don't think there are many people that even know he did that.
So, yeah. What do you think about all of these things that we've been talking about?
Also, I need to give you a massive shout out because it's literally you've created this rundown. Let's just be real. The extensive research you've done, like...
It's giving black historians.
Listen, I'm telling you. Like, you need your own, like... show on the History Channel.
relax.
But no, honestly, incredible work. And just, yeah, like you said before, Arthur Ashe, like the name, when you think Arthur Ashe, you think of the stadium at the US Open.
Mm-hmm.
But like, obviously, he's so much more bigger than that. And like, yeah, these stories kind of are testament to that as well.
For sure.
And just the thing, legacy, like I keep saying legacy, but his legacy literally lives on,
mm-hmm.
and will live on forever.
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
His name will forever be stamped like in ATP history because he formed the ATP tour. Well, he helped form the ATP tour.
Mm-hmm.
The whole code of conduct, like mm-hmm. he wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so he just lives on basically.
Yeah.
I love that. And I really appreciate that. And it's a shame he's not alive today to kind of retell some of these stories himself.
Yeah.
So we could actually hear how he fought, how he felt like mm-hmm. back in the day when some of these things were happening.
Yeah.
But it's so important that basically his story is continuously told. And I hope we've done that justice, like with this episode. And like you said, we're gonna continue to
for sure
kind of tell his story throughout the year with this marking the 50th year of him winning Wimbledon. So
yeah. I think for me, also the reason why it's important is because, again, like I said earlier, when they mention Arthur Ashe, they only like to talk about the fact that he's the first black man and the racial stuff. Yeah. And it kind of takes away...
Which is always significant, but exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's like, there was also more to that. Mm-hmm. Like, the sport is where it's at today because of his influence, mm-hmm. not just because of the fact that, you know... he was the first black man to, like, for example, it's funny how they say they only mention the fact that he's the first black man to have won the US Open, but he's also the first American who's won the US Open due to open era. Because the open era was that year, and then he won the US Open, but all you hear is the first black man. Yeah. And yes, he was the first black man. Yes, he was a black man, but it just shows to you how much they just, you know, just want to just focus on that, but
kind of put him in the box,
and we're used to that. But at Black Screen Global, we're not doing that. We are going to celebrate the whole thing. We're going to keep on sharing his story and his legacy. And I just want to say, despite his influence, diversity in the ATP leadership has remained limited, and no other black individual has held the presidency since him. And when was he the president again? 1973. We are in 2025. You want to tell me you cannot find an ATP black person to be the president? No. Let's see. But I hope it's not a thing where the next time we see an ATP president is one of the players that we have now, who are very young. They're still in their early 20s. Tiafoe's like mid-20s.
To be fair, we've got Songa. Songa's like kind of in player administration now. Like, he's a tournament director.
True. But I wonder if there will be...
James Blake is a tournament director.
Tournament director, Miami Open. But that's what I'm saying. But I think someone like James Blake probably will have more chances, mainly because he's like mainly like in America and stuff. Do you get what I mean?
Although to be fair today, the current president is Italian.
Yes, he is.
Guardenzi.
Yeah. But he's white.
So it doesn't, but I'm saying it doesn't necessarily need to be an American.
He doesn't. Like, I'm saying for them to feel comfortable, we know how it is. So yes, I'm just saying it out there. But either way, again, players' right, fair pay, global expansion helped shape the foundation that made the ATP tour possible today. And it was also because of Ashe's influence. So thank you, Arthur Ashe. And thank you, Arthur Ashe Legacy at UCLA, for allowing us to share his story today. Again, as we said, guys, we are sharing all of these throughout the years in different forms of content, not just when Wimbledon is running. There are so many stories about Arthur Ashe that people don't know, and we are extremely excited to be able to share this. So we hope you enjoyed the pod, and a happy Black History Month.
Happy Black History Month.